Well, ladies and gentlemen, welcome again to another edition of Liberty Unbridled. I am your host, Ken Molman. It is Sunday night, and this is the My View Matters Radio Network. We have a lot to talk about tonight, a whole lot to talk about tonight. So we're going to get right to it. I guess to start out, I should mention the hemp bill that was on. We had last week Katie from the Hemp Museum on and to talk about the hemp bill in Kentucky. That bill did pass the Senate. It got out of committee and then went on to the full Senate. The Senate has passed the bill. The bill is now stuck in the House, and that's really unfortunate because we have an opportunity. This bill doesn't defy federal law. It doesn't do anything illegal or quasi-legal. What this bill does is sets up a framework that if the federal government decides to reclassify hemp, marijuana, all that stuff, to draw a line on THC content or to come up with some other reasonable regulation for what is hemp, what is marijuana, that it puts in place a structure in Kentucky to allow for the licensing and the management of a system of allowing hemp to be grown in Kentucky without allowing those who might be growing marijuana to grow marijuana. And so it is unfortunate that the issue is stuck in the state house, but I guess it shouldn't be a huge surprise. Frankfurt, oftentimes there's partisanship just for the sake of partisanship, and I think that's really, really, really unfortunate. There was a really good article in the Courier-Journal, I believe it was the Courier-Journal, yes, about this, saying that hemp was the great unifier, that it brought people from all different political persuasions together. And in fact, it does. You know, Jamie Comer, obviously Republican, Thomas Massey, Rand Paul, even Mitch McConnell is starting to get on this. So you have the multiple wings of the Republican Party establishment and more liberty-leaning. You had John Yarmuth, our only Democratic representative in D.C., was there and spoke in favor as well. So you basically had a bipartisan group come in and speak in favor of this bill. You had a former CIA director come in and speak in favor of this bill. You have people like, what's his name now? That's horrible. Libertarians are in favor of it. Greens are in favor of it. Ralph Nader, that's who I was trying to remember. He's in favor of it. I mean, you're talking all these different walks of life. And when you get past the FUD, when you get past the sillinesses that are the people that claim that somehow growing hemp is going to enable marijuana to grow. And you know, I'm not saying that there wouldn't be someone that would try it, but to penalize an entire industry or a potential industry because some moron, you know, one moron, two morons try to abuse it, you know, that's not the right approach. I've seen the studies out of UK that were done, I don't even remember now, 15 years ago. It seems like maybe even 20 years ago now. They were back in the 90s that showed that there could be a significant benefit to Kentucky where hemp grown. At one time, Kentucky was the number one producer of hemp in the country. There was a poll done by a new group called Run Switch, which is, I believe McConnell's people are at least in part in that. I know some of the other folks involved in that. The point is that the poll showed that there is 65% support for industrial hemp in the state, and only 16% were leaning towards the, you know, defaulting to the law enforcement position. And that is primarily who is pushing against this. And as we discussed last week, I really believe this is more about the grant money, not about common sense or a good policy. I think that this is something that they're concerned that this may put their grant money at risk. And that's, unfortunately, when it comes to fiefdoms in Kentucky, it's all about the grant money and protecting your fiefdom. So they see this as an attack upon their fiefdom, and I think that's why they are coming out as strongly as they are on the issue. But the hemp bill did pass. Both the Senate committee and the Senate got out, the full Senate, with, I believe, a 2-to-1 margin out of the Senate. And I believe it had bipartisan support in the Senate. So it is in the House now. There was a House bill filed as well. It's been stuck in committee. And for all intents and purposes, we're hearing the bill is DOA there in the House. Now, I'm hoping that perhaps there'll be a discharge petition done to drag it out of committee and to force it to a floor vote. I think that's the best thing that could be done for the bill at this point. If House leadership is going to drag their feet on it, then, you know, you force a vote. And that's done through a discharge petition. I don't know the exact procedure, but I'm told that that's the way to stop someone from killing a bill in a committee. If somebody's got the guts to do it, that very much could be the way it gets done. So that's hemp. Around this, the state, the other issues that came up here, I don't know if it was before the last show or after, but Maker's Mark made an announcement that they were going to start watering down their bourbon because they were running shorter on supplies. You know, they trend all this out. They know how long and what their supply curve looks like. And they were concerned that they were going to run short and they would run out of Maker's Mark for a period of time. And so their solution was to water down Maker's Mark, to drop the alcohol content and really the whole thing, right? I mean, it's not just alcohol content, but it was going to affect the alcohol content and drop it down to, I think it was 86% instead of 90%, which, you know, as someone who enjoys a good bourbon, the alcohol content's not my concern. The alcohol's kind of secondary. I enjoy the flavor of bourbon, and so my concern with it was that it's going to obviously change the flavor of the bourbon to do that. And that was my concern about it. There was a huge public outcry over this, just huge outcry. And just today I saw that Maker's Mark has made the decision that they are not going to water down their bourbon, that they are reversing course, and they put out a big thing and said, hey, listen, we heard the public outcry. We understand we're not going to do this. So kudos to Maker's Mark for listening to their customers. And, you know, they got the memo, listened, and changed their course. So Maker's Mark now apparently will not be watering down their bourbon as they had planned. Speaking of alcohol, saw a study out from another segment of the band Nannies that can't seem to leave things alone. They're showing that they're talking about how alcohol is a contributing factor in cancer, and the number of deaths that alcohol causes, and the study found that 30% of cancer deaths linked to alcohol resulted from 1.5 drinks or less daily. I would fall into the or less category. And I guess the concern here is we're heading down the same route. This is how the smoking stuff started. And I've had this argument over and over and over with friends of mine that are for smoking bans. And you have to understand that it doesn't just stop at a smoking ban. It will keep going. These ban people do not stop. Nannies can't help being nannies. It's what they are. They are the I know better than everybody else. I'm going to force my way onto people type mentality. And so despite the fact that there were some studies that have come out that said that some of the things in alcohol or alcoholic beverages, we've heard about wine, we've heard about the beer and the hops of beer that can actually help with certain medical conditions. They're saying that alcohol causes 10 times as many deaths as it prevents. So they're taking the steps now to put in place, you know, the move, the push to go with alcohol prohibition again. And, you know, that worked out so well the first time. It'll be interesting to see what they do there. But, again, you know, the nannies, they can't stop being nannies. It's what they are. They're going to micromanage your life. They don't, you know, it's one thing to educate people, to tell them information. I'm okay with educating anybody about anything. Give me the information. I am an adult. I will make a decision as an adult as to what to do. I don't think anybody can complain about that position. Where I have problems is when they start saying, okay, well, You know, you're making a bad decision in our eyes, so we're going to make that decision for you. And that's where the band nannies come into play. And it, whether it's cigarettes or alcohol or all kinds of just dumb things. I saw a bunch more stuff come out of New York City again. Now the mayor up there, Bloomberg's trying to ban styrofoam. He's banning everything anywhere, anyhow, anytime. He gets on this, people, they get on these ban kicks and, you know, we got to be banning something. And that seems to be what's going on in general. I just very, very frustrated because a lot of people don't see this coming. And I'm trying to tell you folks, listen, you know, any minority behavior is in danger because the nannies will come after your minority behavior sometime in the future. And you may not like drinking and you may not like smoking, but there's something that you do that is a minority behavior that has some sort of associated risk, whether it's real or perceived, that at some point someone is going to try to take that activity and make it illegal so you can't do it. I mean, I like to, one of the things I like to do is whitewater rafting. And you know what? People die from that every single year. And certainly, you don't have to go whitewater rafting. There's nothing that says, oh, well, you know, if you go whitewater rafting, you know, there's nothing that's quote-unquote beneficial to whitewater rafting. It's some exercise, but you can get exercise other ways. The point being that you take your minority behavior, whether it's whitewater rafting, whatever it is, and you look, there's danger in anything we do. There's a danger in rolling out of bed in the morning. You could slip, fall, crack your head open, and die. I mean, there is danger in every single thing that we do. If you let the nannies continue to attack minority behaviors, you're going to at some point be on the wrong end of it. And I can't emphasize that enough. I keep trying to bring this up to folks. They don't get it. Please, please, please understand that a proper way to handle a situation where you walk onto someone's private property and they're doing something you don't like is to turn around and leave. In the case of a business, you don't patronize the business, you turn around and leave. And you vote with your feet. That is the appropriate way to handle that situation. If you don't like what a property owner is doing, then leave the property. It's that simple. I see somebody's in the whole queue, and I don't know if they're just listening or whatever, but again, if you're listening, and I should have mentioned this before, if you want to call in about any of the topics tonight, the number here is area code 858-683-1326. You can also just listen in on that number, but if you want to talk, you got to press 1 once you call in, and that will alert me that you want to speak to me. So if you want to talk about any of this stuff, if you want to just listen in, whatever, that's all fine, but I see folks are in the queue, but nobody's pressed 1, so I want to make sure that that was clear. So anyhow, so speaking of nannies, there was an interesting article that came out today about Obamacare, and that the Obamacare, the part of it was the pre-existing high-risk pool, right, the people with pre-existing conditions that couldn't get insurance. That was the big push, excuse me, the big push behind Obamacare. And it turns out that this pool has about 100,000 people in it right now because of some weird things that have to be done in order to enroll in it. You have to be without insurance for 6 months, and you have to meet these qualifications and all this different stuff. But the pool was originally slated to have about 250,000 people in it, and it was supposed to come a lot faster, according to certain critics. Well, those numbers weren't attained, but there are 100,000 people in it now, and supposedly, sometime between yesterday and March 2nd, the high-risk pool will stop taking new people into the pool because they're out of money. So basically, one of the key tenets of this whole thing was the high-risk, not insurable, no ability to get insurance, folks. We've got 100,000 of these people now in the pool, and okay. But there's certainly more of those people out there, and we're out of money already. So what are we going to do? We're going to raise the cost again? We're going to raise taxes to cover this again? I mean, I don't want anybody to suffer. I'm not a heartless, awful person. But it just seems to me that every time we see a story about Obamacare, it's something about how it's falling on its face. Besides the stories that, it's happy and there's no real data behind it, no real numbers. Whenever there's a number put out, it's always a bad number. It's never something like, hey, you know, Obamacare just saved $1 billion. We don't see those stories. We see things about, hey, Obamacare being kicked in made insurance rates go up by 30-something percent instead of 20-something percent as the industry would have had predicted for this year had we not had Obamacare. So premiums have increased more so than they would have otherwise. That didn't surprise me a bit. We see the thing about now with the pool running out of money. Well, that doesn't surprise me either. You know, when you start giving away stuff for free, you're asking for trouble. You're going to get people in that, and I don't want to say they're abusing it. I don't want to go there with it, but there's no such thing as a free lunch, folks, and there is no free. There's nothing free. It comes from somewhere, and, this pool was undersized and then probably done intentionally so to keep the cost of Obamacare down because supposedly this is all supposed to be revenue neutral or save money over time. The reality is it pushes most of the cost to the states. It's underfunded. It's not going to work. But anyway, I just thought that was an interesting story. And speaking of exchanges, we've had folks on this show talk about the insurance exchange that's been set up in Kentucky. And there was a story by Roger Alford today in the AP talking about how the new, what do they call this, the Office of Kentucky Health Benefits Exchange has about 30 employees, which is about the same as the Secretary of State's office, but it has a whole bunch of contractors and an annual budget 10 times larger than the Secretary of State at just shy of $40 million. Now, understand the Secretary of State's office, for people that don't know, is in charge of running all elections in the state. They're in charge of basically every business in the state as far as business filings and getting licensing and whatnot. The Secretary of State's office has a big responsibility. Yet they can do the health insurance. And this is just the maintenance piece, right? This is building the computer program, as some say. That piece of it. And it's huge. It's a huge, huge cost. Our state's upside down anyway. And how in the world can we afford this? I have no idea. It'd be pretty interesting to see how that comes out because I just don't see where this money's going to come from. At some point, the feds are going to cut off their federal money, or maybe they won't. Maybe they'll just keep printing it and handing it out. That's an answer, too, I guess, at least for temporary purposes. But at some point, the onus is going to fall back on these state exchanges, and the states are going to scream bloody murder because, you know, quite frankly, we're not going to have the money to pay for this. We're not going to have the money. We're already – Kentucky's debt-to-GDP ratio, if it's not the worst, is one of the worst in the country. Our state's debt as a percentage of our GDP is over 25%. And when I did some random spot checking, just picked random states, and this is off of usdebtclock.org. If you've never been there, go to usdebtclock.org, and it'll give you a very nice graphic. If you're using a Linux box like I do, the flash animations absolutely drag the machine to a halt. But it has an accurate count of federal debt, and then there's a place where you can go to state debt clocks, and you can see, compare different states. Most states are sitting in the teens, the mid-teens, as far as their debt-to-GDP ratio. We're over 25%, and the best that I had found was Wyoming, which seems to have about a 7.25% debt-to-GDP ratio. So Kentucky's not got money to throw around. We're probably in some of the worst shape. I've heard that certain analysts have called us the Greece of the United States, that, you know, we're in some bad, bad shape here in Kentucky. And it's going to take some leadership. It's going to take some folks to stand up and say, we don't want this anymore. It's going to take an understanding from the public that we're going to have to cut some services to get this fixed. And we're going to have to cut some regulations in order to get some businesses in here and not have to pay them off to come. Because paying off a business to come isn't really a solution. You're just shifting the tax burden to all these other businesses that want to be here in the state and have grown here in the state, and you're putting an unfair burden on them while their competitors get a freebie. They get a pass. And they may be direct competitors and they may be indirect competitors. And by indirect competitors, I mean they may be competing for the same talent pool for types of work. You know, a secretary can work for Company A or Company B. It's secretarial work. But Company B gets a tax abatement and can pay that person 5% or 10% more. Well, you know, if you've got a higher budget for secretary, then you're going to get the better secretary, right? That's what happens in a market. People seek out the maximum that they can make in a job. And so that's how you become an indirect competitor. But we've got some problems, and we need to get a handle on them and quick. And the longer we go, the worse it gets. Our pension, they keep talking about the pension stuff, and the big solution for the pension now is they want to tie increasing cigarette taxes to fixing our pension problem. That is not going to work. First of all, the intent, and they'll tell you in their studies that back this, the higher you make the tobacco tax, the fewer people smoke. They, you know, hey, like the old saying goes, you want to kill something, you tax it, right? You tax it to death. And so that's what they're doing. So, and the number of people who are smoking declines as a percentage of the population in the state every day. So you're talking about a temporary revenue source to try to solve a permanent problem. That's not going to work. Unless you reform the system itself and change what is causing it to go bankrupt, adding more funding is only a temporary solution. And hey, yeah, it's fun to go tax the crap out of smokers. That seems to be the fun thing to do because I guess we're an easy target. You know, smokers are a minority. But that's not a solution. That's a Band-Aid to a very serious problem. We have to be looking at a broader level. We have to be looking at what can we do to solve some of our fundamental problems in the state. Because certainly a Band-Aid is not what we need. We get Band-Aids every year or every 2 years out of the General Assembly. We don't need any more Band-Aids. We've got plenty of Band-Aids. You know, makes me wonder if these folks have stock in Band-Aids. But seriously, the point is that we are not in a position to keep putting Band-Aids on these problems. We actually have to solve them. And there's problems throughout the state. I mean, all these local taxing entities, how many billions of dollars get drug into those things and wasted on garbage? You know, the auditor had a very good report out earlier this year, and I believe we've talked about that on the show in the past. I talked to so many people, folks. I apologize. Sometimes I forget about what we've talked about, what we haven't. It's very difficult when you live and breathe politics, you know, in your free time to remember what you've told to who. But the point, we have to have a real come-to-Jesus moment on a lot of this stuff. We can't keep doing what we're doing. We're going to hit the wall. When we hit the wall, you know, what happens then? We go back to the feds and beg them to bail us out? Any federal money we get comes with strings. We're going to get into the gun control thing here in a minute, but, you know, you don't think that at some point the state wouldn't be willing to sell out our gun rights for some grant money? I guarantee you they will. Because when it comes down to it, our state's broken. We're in trouble. And if the feds say, hey, you know, we're going to give you a sweetheart grant, all you got to do is curb some gun rights. Count on it. Frankfurt will jump all over it in a heartbeat. Oh, they'll find some way to say, they'll find a bureaucracy, either a bureaucracy will implement it and the General Assembly will whine and say, oh my gosh, we can't do that, but they won't act. Or something to that effect. But the reality is that in many cases, our rights are being sold for grant money. I mean, just like I mentioned with the smoking ban stuff, why do you think that's being pushed here so hard? Millions of dollars in federal grant money has been poured into this state to push smoking bans in this state. That's why they keep pushing it. That's why they don't go away. No matter how many times they get shot down, they're not going to go away because of the federal money that gets poured in here. And who cares about property rights? And who cares about individual right to associate? We're going to keep pouring money in. As long as they keep pouring money in, those groups will keep pushing. And they get money if they pass a ban. They get implementation money in these local health districts and health departments. And that's why they're for them. Because, hey, I get an extra 50 or 100 grand a year or whatever it is. That helps perpetuate and grow their little fiefdom. It's all about the fiefdoms in government. I see we got a caller on the line that wants to speak. I'm going to bring him on here real quick. Caller, you're on the air.
Hey, how's it going? This is Mayo.
Oh, hey, Mayo. How's it going, brother?
Oh, pretty good. It's kind of like where to start. I mean, you know, Kentucky taxing the heck out of tobacco. It's like killing the goose that laid the golden egg. And, I mean, I don't know, I'm sure you know it. I don't know about the other listeners, but tobacco and alcohol, you know, why are they the only two things which are taxed at over 50%? You know, you go out and buy a six-pack of beer and it costs $7. $3.50 or more of that is just to pay tax.
Yeah.
Because that's the way they've done the increase.
Because it's a minority behavior. That's why. It's easy to tax a minority behavior. It's all about taxing somebody else. So it's your turn.
The other thing, you know, you're talking about hemp earlier. I mean, how many different drugs have valid, viable uses, but they also have some bad things? I mean, you know, poppy for, you know, different painkillers, medications, anesthetics, et cetera, but also, oh, yeah, it can be heroin. You know, so you can take whatever point. I can't remember what science fiction you were talking about, the nanny state science fiction author 40 years ago, whether it was Ray Bradbury or Philip K. Dick, but society had gotten to the point robots controlled humans. You couldn't even whittle because you might cut yourself. You know, so you got
right to
play with Play-Doh and a plastic knife. and taking it to the
far extreme. I think that's
far,
what they do on airplanes,
you know,
now, right? Isn't that what we get on airplanes now? Play-Doh and a plastic knife?
Something like that. But, I mean, something that is, I mean, I don't mind being on certain things educated, like you were talking about earlier, put the facts out there, let the people vote and decide and say, okay, we're going to have a vote on hemp. Here are the facts for, here are the facts against. And what gets me is, I'm not a parent, I don't have a child in school, but I've read different articles where, like, the LGBT community, I mean, they actually have people that tour go to schools. Now, you can't teach safe sex or, you know, hand out condoms or things of that nature in a school, but yet these groups have grants from the federal government, and they can go in and show safe techniques.
Right.
For, you know, different sex. I don't know if it's, you know, we're not on regular radio, but still trying to, you know, but it's okay
right
for them
I
to show
to
that,
so
but
safe
yet you can't teach right safe sex, you know, for heterosexual. Why is that okay? You know, why is the one okay but not the other? And, you know, whether it's the fiefdom or the squeaky wheel that gets the grease, and that's what kills me. We're not the minority, we're the majority, but why aren't more people speaking out? You know, I mean, actually write a letter, send it to your congressman. Don't send an email petition, don't send whatever. And maybe if, you know, some congressman, senator, or someone else got, you know, a couple of 100,000 bags of actual letters delivered to their office to where it swamped them, you know, and send it certified mail so they have to get a signature if you really want to push it, and see what kind of effect that has versus, you know, just being able to hit a delete button on a computer.
Well, certainly, and there are effective ways to contact your folks down in Frankfurt and in D.C. I think in Frankfurt, some of the best ways to do that, you know, we've had people, encourage people to call down there and send what's called a green slip, and that seems to be one of the most effective ways. If you send them an email, half the guys down there in Frankfurt don't know how to use email. So sending them an email is, you know, literally just writing a message to nobody, sticking it in a bottle and tossing it in the ocean, you know, hoping somebody will read it. You know, that's not really helpful. But, no, I think that it is important to be in touch with our elected officials and make them aware of these things. And in many ways, it is the squeaky wheels that get the grease, because the squeaky wheels are the ones that are motivated to go out and vote. I mean, look at the number of people that don't actually vote in this country. You know, the ones that are voting are the ones that have a voice. And if you want to make a change, that's, you know, what it takes, is you got to go vote.
Well, I mean, until they get the none of the above on the ballots, which I wish was there. I mean, you can vote for impeachment or start or term limits. I mean, you know, make it 12 years. Doesn't matter what office you're in, Senator, you know, Senate, Congress, Representative, you can only serve a maximum of 12 years in any one position or three terms or something, and then you wouldn't have these fiefdoms. I think, you know, Ed Martin, you know, the political class, you know, how he terms it, but they think they're, like you were saying, the fiefdoms. They think they're barons and dukes, et cetera, and in a lot of ways, no, they have gotten away. I mean, Rand Paul, that's why I like him. I mean, you know, more towards the common man knows what it's like. You know, whereas McConnell's been in there for 30 years getting his behind, you know, Learjetted and limoed and everything else around and not having to be searched on TSA when he gets on a flight and everything else, get people in there that want the job and are going to realize, you know, the commonality of everybody else's, you know, the real experience. Not, oh, I've been here for 30 years and I'm pampered. No, that's not a real experience anymore. You're living a fantasy. That's not
right.
The real experience for the average American.
No, and that's absolutely the case. And I think some of those elected officials not only understand that it's different than the average American, but some of them actually believe they're entitled to it. You know, Nancy
Pelosi,
I think it was this week, yeah, said that Congress taking a pay cut would be demeaning to Congress and below them. What?
Well,
excuse me?
You know. Well, it's like I've mentioned it on, you know, Ed's show before, but it's like I can't remember if it was Mazzoni or Bunning. You know, they were on three different committees, the wage and hour, the immigration, and another one. And they told the House, they said, this is a three-legged stool. If you do not keep up with any one of them, it'll fall over. Well, Congress has given themselves, well, maybe a few years back, I think they kind of stopped, or the Republicans, you know, signed something. But, you know, minimum wage was supposed to keep up with the cost of living every year. That way it was a slight incremental increase to an employer and not a big jump in the rest of society, whether you want to say the cost of bread, milk, you know, your grocery items, et cetera. Well, now, like in the State of the Union address, Obama says, oh, $9 an hour, but was this the catch going to be for full-time employees, like he said in the speech, whereas if you still work part-time, oh, you'll still be stuck at $7.25. You know, there's been
right.
How many ever states that have raised, you know, their minimum wage has been $9 or over. I think Washington State's like $9.41 or something an hour. You know, but what is that going? So you raise minimum wage to $9 an hour. Okay, now what's a loaf of bread going to go up to? $2.50? Because they have to pay their employees. You know, what's a gallon of milk going to go up to? $5?
Right. Well,
so,
and that's, a lot of people don't realize, you know, the money all has to come from somewhere. Right, it's not like it just magically appears, although given the Federal Reserve just printing money, I guess it does technically just magically appear. But when it comes to the value of labor, labor has a certain value to it. And it doesn't matter if it, you know, if it's the minimum wage is $5 or $50, if it's a job that is worth today $5 and you increase minimum wage to $50, it didn't increase the value of that job in the economy. It just means that, you know, the value of dollars, the way we represent what that value is, has increased. But the true value of that service, that good, that labor is really still the same. And that's really the key thing that people miss in the minimum wage fight, is that labor's just worth a certain amount. I mean, that's just what it is. It's whether it's and you back up to barter system, right? So if you have a cow and you want to trade it for a certain amount of wheat or grain or whatever, the fact that minimum wage is $5 or $50 doesn't change the value of that cow, doesn't change the value of that wheat or grain. They still have intrinsic value. And so you can make minimum wage $500 an hour, and it isn't going to make that big of a difference. All it's going to do is super inflate everything and wipe out anybody who saved a nickel, wipe out their savings. The minimum wage fight, I don't even want to get on that tangent. That drives me absolutely crazy. But, and Mayo, I need to take a break here because I'm over for my break. But, I see you dropped off anyway. So thanks for calling in. The folks, we're going to take a quick break here. We got a lot left to cover in the second half of the show. So if you'd like to call in, you can do so. Again, the number here is 858-683-1326. 858-683-1326. You are listening to Liberty Unbridled on the My View Matters Radio Network.
I fall off my chair, and I'm wondering how I Being a victim of crime is no joke, but you do have options that can help you avoid becoming a victim. I'm Ed Springsteen of the My View Matters radio show, and on behalf of myself and co-host Ed Martin, I urge each of you to help us fight against crime. You can do your part by calling Crime Stoppers at 582-CLUE. Since 1982, Crime Stoppers has helped get over 23,000 criminals off the street with your help. Working together, we can make a difference to take our streets back. Please call Crime Stoppers at 582-CLUE, or you can visit them online at www.582clue.com. Remember, Crime Stoppers always offers up to a $1,000 reward. Get involved and help make a positive change in your neighborhood. Thanks.
Advertisers, here's a great way to reach a quality audience. Get heard on My View Matters and make some noise in the marketplace.
Email myviewmatters@aol.com for advertising opportunities. Make a sound investment.
All right, and we're back, folks. You are listening to Liberty Unbridled on the My View Matters radio network. And thankfully, I don't have to do that commercial break anymore. So getting right back to it, we have... food stamps. There's a new story out about food stamps in America versus the number of new jobs. And they're, you know, the number they're throwing out, there's a 75-to-1 ratio on the number of new jobs versus the number of new people on welfare, and welfare being the 75 times more. But that's a little bit of a funny math thing, but essentially what it boils down to is that over the course of the past 2 years, there's basically 200,000 new jobs in America, but over 15 million more people, or about 15 million more people, on food stamps. And so that kind of explains, you know, the continued down economy. You know, we keep throwing stimulus money out there for projects that don't matter and things that aren't going to help us in the long term. And it's not putting people back to work. It's just putting them on food stamps. And so, you know, more continued mess from D.C. that continues to cause problems. And things are not getting better. And I don't think things are going to get better this year, folks. I hate to be the bearer of bad news, but with all these new regulations, Obamacare kicking in fully at the end of this year, and everything else in the world going on, I just don't see things getting better. So buckle up. Hold tight, and if you got a job, hang on to it. And if you can get a job, get it and hang on to it as tight as you can. So that's my advice on that. We have the smoking ban. I mentioned that before, the smoking stuff. A quick update on that. House Bill 190, which is the statewide smoking ban proposal this year, is passed through committee. It's been heard twice. It was put on the orders of the day to be passed on Friday. It looks like, if I'm interpreting the very cryptic orders of the day sheet, that the version that they're going to be voting on is the version that is the floor amendment. And the floor amendment version, Representative Stanley from Lexington put an exemption in for e-cigarettes. The band folks love to pick on the e-cigarettes now, because as the e-cigarettes have taken off, it hasn't, people are switching from smoking to the e-cigarettes rather than from smoking to the gums and the patches and all that stuff. And make no mistake, a lot of the money that comes in to all of this smoking ban stuff comes from the people who are selling the gums and the patches and all that stuff. So they're trying to put the kibosh on the e-cigarettes now as well. Meanwhile, the e-cigarette people have now formed a lobby. So it's always interesting to see how that goes. Always interesting to see things change. You know, they had a big, the pro-ban people had a big rally in Frankfurt on Thursday, and they brought in Miss Kentucky, and they brought in a guy who was formerly a UK player, now an NBA player, and they were the big to-do, and a whole bunch of the news picked up the fact that those folks were in town, and, by the way, it was for the smoking ban, but really just kind of picked up that they were there, and the stories mainly revolved around their being here, and it's kind of funny that the news coverage on that, I don't think, was exactly what the pro-ban people wanted, but too bad for them. I assume everybody saw the stuff about the manhunt, and the way that all kind of ended was burning the dude in the house alive, probably. They're claiming now that he killed himself, single gunshot wound to the head, prior to the building getting burnt all the way down. And there's some debate over who set fire to the building. You know, I've seen the transcripts and I've heard the recordings of what was going on. People did record that, and there were also people that were transcribing it. And it's very obvious to me that the police did, in fact, set fire to that building. They talk about sending in the burners. Okay, we're sending in the burners. Okay, the building's on fire. I mean, I don't know what else a burner is. And they're talking about sending it over to that particular corner of a house. They use numbers for all that stuff. And, oh, okay, we sent it over to that corner, and now that corner's on fire. And it's like, well, yeah, that's pretty obvious they set that on fire. Been quite an issue of debate here this past week. It's very, very interesting. The fight has mainly been over whether or not the police acted or overreacted to this. And a lot of people I've talked to, it seems pretty split. They either think, as I do, that the police overstepped their bounds and infringed upon the due process rights of the guy, was named Dorner. They think that they, you know, I think they infringe. It's not their job to be the judge, jury, and executioner. Their job is to try to bring the guy in alive so he can face a judge and a jury of his peers. That's what due process is about. Others think that they acted within the right realm. But look at the other things that happened, the warrantless searches that happened. I think they said somewhere in the neighborhood of 400 of those. Civilians that were fired on first, questions asked later, because they drove a vehicle that looked like this guy's vehicle. Or, you know, they looked like the guy. And that's crazy. You can't just assume that stuff. I mean, it was way, 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 way out of control. And that was something that I'm hoping that out of all of this, we get some clarification, and hopefully on the positive side, that the police can't go around burning people's homes down just because they won't come out, or really burning other people's homes down because somebody inside won't come out, and that police can't shoot first and ask questions later. I mean, that stuff can't be allowed to fly. It's going to turn out really, really bad for all of us, the normal people, the ones that aren't doing bad things, if due process is allowed to be abridged. There was a policeman, a California policeman, that came out here not too long ago on whether or not guns are a defensive weapon, and they say that it's a myth, that it's not a defensive weapon, that guns are used to intimidate people, and that's why the police use them. And, in fact, I've got audio here, and we're going to try to play it here. I apologize. It's not the best setup here, but we're going to play it right now. So hang on just a moment here.
One issue that...
Oh, and of course it crashes.
One issue that always boggles my mind is that the idea that a gun is a defensive weapon, that is a myth. A gun is not a defensive weapon. A gun is an offensive weapon used to intimidate and used to show power. Police officers do not carry a gun as a defensive weapon to defend themselves or their other officers. They carry a gun to be able to do their job in a safe and effective manner and face any oppositions that we may come upon. If it was a defensive measure, why did we lose 55 officers nationwide last year to gun violence? And unfortunately, in just the 2 months of this year so far, we've lost 2 officers to gun violence in the state of California alone. We deal with gun violence on a daily basis. We are asking and have been asking for reasonable regulations, not that are going to impact the legal gun owner. We're asking for reasonable regulations that will help us keep our communities and our officers safe. Thank you.
So it's very interesting to hear a police officer say that they're not using firearms to protect themselves. They're using firearms to intimidate people and to force them to cooperate. Now, certainly officers do use it in that way, but the reason that the new non-lethal weapons, right, the tasers and the pepper sprays and all that are supposed to be at the disposal of an officer is to subdue someone. It's not supposed to be. Their job is not to be the judge, jury, and executioner of someone who's suspected, or even if they know they've committed a crime. That's not their job to determine that. That's not their job to put forth a sentence. their job is to apprehend someone so that they can face a judge and a jury of their peers to be held accountable for their actions. And it's up to the judge and the jury to decide what their fate is, not a police officer. Now, certainly, if a police officer is being fired upon by a suspect, they have the right to defend themselves with any means that is reasonable, right? They can't, for instance, if somebody steals a candy bar and runs into a house, they can't burn a house down. That's not reasonable. If somebody is firing a weapon at them, they can fire a weapon back. That is reasonable defense. That is what they're supposed to be using lethal force for, only when they absolutely have to. Not as a means of intimidation, not as a means of forcing compliance with their orders. And I have a very serious concern that we're moving the wrong direction on this stuff. And the people that are defending the burning of that house with a guy inside with no, you know, means of giving him a means to peacefully surrender, folks, you got to think about where this all leads. I mean, the police cannot be given more power than the average citizen or when they're off duty, and they can't be given the ability to be the judge, jury, and executioner. That's not their job. Their job is to apprehend a criminal so that they can face the jury of their peers with due process. But we got to move on. We got a lot, and we only have 9 minutes. So there was a story about the continued bank bailouts that are happening behind the scenes, not obviously getting the fanfare from before, because, boy, there was a backlash against that. Pretty much everybody said, no, the bank shouldn't get one, and people got them, and that really was a big part of what started the whole Tea Party movement with the bank bailouts. And it's something that both the Tea Party and Occupy Wall Street, and pretty much anybody with a brain, agrees was the wrong thing to do. You don't bail out people that are engaged in bad behavior. You don't reward them for their bad behavior. So behind the scenes now, there's bank bailouts going on behind the scenes. The Fed is helping out Bank of America. I'll tell you, folks, we got to keep an eye on this stuff. And I know there's so many issues out there. There's so much going on. But this is another one of those issues, and it's just another example of how the bureaucracy and the Fed is its own thing, and we dedicate a whole show to that. But the people with the power of the printing press are working behind the scenes to help the big guys at the expense of the little guys. And you're going to see more and more and more that your small local community bank is going to have to close or sell out to a bigger guy because the regulations and the way things are working, the little guys are getting squeezed out. And we're going to end up with one or two or three big banks, and that's it. And that's the way it is with all these corporations. We're going to end up with one or two or three big names in any particular business segment, and that's it. They're squeezing the little guys out. And whether it's intentional or accidental or they just don't care, that's what's happening. And you're going to see that trend continue. And it's going to continue the bad economy. It's going to continue this push where more people are getting on food stamps than getting jobs. Small businesses are what drive our economy out of recession. People willing to take the risk because they're going to go broke anyway. You might as well grow broke in 2 months rather than 6 months. They're the ones that help drive the economy back out of recession. And with all these regulations, it's not happening. And that's what we're seeing. Too many regulations, not enough small businesses, prolonged recession. Moving on, because we only have a few minutes left. There was a story about Jeb Bush came out, and he said that he would govern like Lyndon B. Johnson, which is a pretty tantalizing headline. And basically what it comes down to is that Johnson apparently is known for schmoozing the Senate. He was very good at working the Senate to get what he wanted done, working with the Senate and making deals and all that stuff. I don't think that's really what people want. I don't think that even the bad headline, if you take the bad headline away and you look at just the idea on its facts or on its face, that people are not looking for somebody who's going to schmooze the Congress to get things moving. That's not what people want. They want answers to problems, not backroom deals. They don't want this, you know, all this happening behind the scenes. They want a transparent process with clear answers, clear direction. They want answers that's not working things in a smoke-filled back room. And all the while, Karl Rove has the headline is that Rove declares war on the Tea Party. The establishment is fighting back, and they're going to work to make sure that people who have fiscal issues first in mind running as Republicans are going to fail in Republican primaries. And that's they're going to pump a bunch of money in to try to take out anybody who is running in a primary who is a fiscal conservative. And that should send big, big, big alarm bells to those in the liberty community in general. You know, some folks in the Tea Party are more liberty-oriented than others, but the Tea Party is all about fiscal issues. And those people that work together on the fiscal issues, you need to realize the Republican Party is not your friend. The Republican Party, the establishment, is going to work against you. They're not just going to not work with you. They're going to work against you. And you need to understand that. I've been trying to beat the drum. We beat the drum on that for almost a year now, as long as this show's been on. They're not your friend. Period. Meanwhile, Rand Paul came out and said that it seems like the country is ready for a libertarian Republican president. And talking about, here in recent weeks, has been talking about trying to scale back some of our military operations and trying to do things a little bit smarter and fiscally conservatively. And he's focusing, obviously, on the fiscal side, but even on the foreign policy, because that foreign policy being all over the world costs a lot of money, folks. And we have this issue up here in Northern Kentucky with $2 billion for a bridge. As much money as we dumped into Iraq and Afghanistan, both with personnel and support and all that, plus what we rebuilt over there, we could have built that bridge. We could have built the bridge in Louisville. We could have built a lot of bridges in this country. And it comes down to priorities. What do you want? You want to screw around in the Middle East and try to bring stability to a region that hasn't been stable in 3,000-plus years? Or do you want to build a bridge here? There's your question. I know my answer. I don't know what yours is, but that's my answer. The last thing tonight for the show before we head boogie out, there's, again, two bad things going through Congress. CISPA's back. Hooray! The bill to monitor and filter and basically censor the Internet has returned once again. Now, I've seen some rumors that Obama had thrown some stuff in through executive order, but I haven't been able to research that. But the bill itself is back in Congress, and they are pushing it forward again. And it's up to all of us, again, to step up and tell our reps, no, we do not want the Internet to be filtered. We do not want the Internet to be censored. We don't need to live in China. Folks, that's what they do in China. China filters the Internet. We don't filter the Internet here in America. We believe in freedom of information, and that's what's empowered so many of these liberty activists throughout the country. And finally, wrapping up for the night, again, it's back. Sales tax on the Internet, we're back again. And it's going to create a mess. If they do the sales tax on the Internet stuff, it's going to be a disaster. It's not going to work. The only way to be able to even try to do that would be to have a standard tax across the board, across the whole U.S. And we don't have that, and we're not going to have that. And that's just the way it is. I'm sorry, we're just not going to have the same tax policy across the nation because we have 50 different states with 50 different needs and 50 different mechanisms, and that's a good thing. We don't need to have all of that universal policy across the United States because, you know, God forbid the U.S. would adopt the policies of Kentucky where the whole dang, you know, every state would be 27% in debt, you know, as compared to its GDP. That wouldn't be good. And that's why we have 50 different states. They have 50 different systems and 50 different ways of working problems out. That's a good thing. Folks, we've reached the end of the show. Mayo, I'm sorry I see you called back in, brother, but I have to end the show. Folks, tune in next week, 7 p.m. every week, Sunday night. This is Liberty Unbridled on the My View Matters Radio Network.